So I have a healthy daughter, and I gave birth at Columbia University in New York City. And in brief, I'll sort of tell you the story. She was born on a Sunday night. Her heart rate had gone down. So my OB decided to do an emergency C-section, and she was born and healthy, but I didn't feel so well afterwards. And it wasn't until the next morning that my OB came in, took one look at me, and realized that I had been bleeding internally the whole night.
Maternal mortality is a problem that is growing, or at least stalling, in the US and in select economies around the world. Many of these experiences are shocking, occurring to otherwise healthy women. They are occurring in some of the most reputable medical establishments that the country knows. Many of the sufferers don't know what they are experiencing and don't even have the words to give voice to it. In the US, every 12 hours, a woman dies due to complications resulting from pregnancy. Additionally, two babies die each day. According to data from the National Center for Health Statistics, the maternal mortality rate for 2021 was 32.9 deaths per 100,000 live births, compared with the rate of 23.8 in 2020 and 20.1 in 2019. In 2021, the maternal mortality rate for non-Hispanic Black women was 69.9 deaths per 100,000 live births, 2.6 times the rate for non-Hispanic white women. Rates for Black women were significantly higher than rates for white and Hispanic women. The increases from 2020 to 2021 for all race and Hispanic origin groups were significant. In 2020, the US remains among the most dangerous developed nations for a woman to give birth. In this podcast series, we are focusing on first expounding the problem of maternal mortality within the US and on stating the nature of the problem. We are speaking with experts throughout the country. We are then going to ask why this remains such a persistent problem and look to how we can alleviate it. We will ask what has been tried, where money has been spent. We'll see what has failed and what continues to fail to serve women throughout the country. We will explore what has been proven to make a difference in alleviating this problem, and we'll ask what advances in digital health can bring. Finally, in the third part, we will look around the world at solutions that have worked there to lead to a better outcome for mothers and babies. We've already heard from Anisha Gia, who has used her own traumatic birth experience to develop a career that is focused on addressing and funding women's health. Let's hear Manisha's full story. We will hear later from another survivor, Adonica Shaw, about her traumatic birth experience. Because sharing the details and the stories matter, and finding the words around trauma and shared lived experience matters. Let's hear more from Manisha.
So I have a healthy daughter, and I gave birth at Columbia University in New York City. And in brief, I'll sort of tell you the story. She was born on a Sunday night. Her heart rate had gone down. So my OB decided to do an emergency C-section, and she was born and healthy, but I didn't feel so well afterwards. And it wasn't until the next morning that my OB came in, took one look at me, and realized that I had been bleeding internally the whole night. So she rushed me into the OR, back into the OR, and brought in three additional surgeons. And the four of them spent 2 hours with me open, looking for the source of the bleed. They couldn't find the source of the bleed. So finally, they closed me up and took me to the ICU. And I was given a number of transfusions, 8 transfusions of blood and 2 transfusions of platelets. And it came to the point where the OB told my husband that she didn't think I would make it to the next morning. So it got pretty bad. In addition, she sort of broke protocol and had them bring my newborn, my 1-day-old, into the ICU to see me. She didn't think I had much longer, and she wanted me to have an opportunity to at least have a picture with my daughter. So I only remember bits and pieces of this since I was in and out of it in terms of consciousness, but my husband will recount every moment. I do recall being handed my daughter, and I remember the nurse having to put her hand underneath because I wasn't strong enough to hold her by myself. And then in the subsequent hours, my body started catching up with the bleed. And after a few weeks in the hospital, I was able to come home. This experience was very significant and traumatic for me. Here I was at one of the top academic institutions in the United States at Columbia University with a highly experienced care team. And yet there was so much more that could have been done. And it brought to light for me the need and the opportunity within women's health.
Part one, the problem. What way are we measuring the problem of maternal mortality? And what kind of surveillance system exists? Since 1987, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Division of Reproductive Health, has overseen the Pregnancy Mortality Surveillance System. Factors include maternal age, and mortality rates increase with age. The rate for women aged 40 and over was 6.8 times higher than the rate for women under age 25. Most maternal morbidity occurs after leaving the hospital. Today in the US, 7 million women of childbearing age live in counties without access to or with limited access to maternity care. These women are giving birth to more than 500,000 babies a year, and this is putting them at risk of serious health complications. Without access to routine, quality health care, these moms and babies have an increased chance of maternal and infant mortality and morbidity, including low birth weight and preterm birth. From 2000 to 2015, the era of the Millennium Development Goals, the global maternal mortality ratio fell by 33% and by more than half in 58 countries with the highest rates of maternal mortality. A report for the WHO and the UN in the first 5 years of the Sustainable Development Goals saw that maternal mortality had barely declined, if at all. Put simply, we are currently off track to achieve the SDG target on maternal mortality. On current trends, more than 1 million additional maternal deaths globally will occur by 2030. In mapping the availability of maternity care resources, including obstetric care, birth centers, OBGYNs, and certified nurse midwives across the United States, the March of Dimes has uncovered a large number of maternity care deserts, which are defined as counties in which access to maternity health care is limited or absent, either through lack of services or barriers to a woman's ability to access that care within counties. We also talk here about social determinants of health, which are defined as conditions in environments in which people are born, live, learn, work, play, worship, and age that affect a wide range of health, functioning, and quality of life outcomes and risks. Access to healthcare is interwoven with both economic stability and neighborhood environment. Black people tend to give birth in hospitals marked by lower quality of care indicators than the hospitals where white people give birth. There is also the question of representation when it comes to medical professionals. For example, while 14% of birthing individuals in the US identify as Black, only 6.3% of certified nurse and midwives and 11% of OBGYNs identify as Black. The high cost for enrolling and completing doula and midwifery training and low payment once in the field may serve as barriers for people of color entering the perinatal workforce. The US is distinctive in that approximately 91% of hospital births are attended by a physician, while 8.7% are attended by midwives. The majority of other high-income countries rely much more heavily on midwifery care and are fewer hospital births. Access to midwifery care is currently limited by state scope of practice laws, which in many states require nurse midwives to be supervised by a physician. Lack of coverage via Medicaid or many commercial birth insurers and high out-of-pocket costs also prevent access to doula services and non-hospital births. Why is this a problem? Cost. It is estimated that 9 common maternal morbidity conditions associated with births in a given year cost society $32.3 billion from the beginning of pregnancy through 5 years postpartum. This lack of comprehensive data for other conditions suggests that maternal morbidity has the potential to exact a much higher toll on society than what we have found. In this, it would rival expensive chronic conditions like diabetes, where costs can run into hundreds of billions of dollars. Yele Aluko is chief medical officer in EY America's health advisory practice, a position he has held for 4 years. He advises health system C-suite and senior executives on strategy and business operations, and provides insight on mega trends confronting the health industry. He's the director of the EY Center for Health Equity and holds numerous advisory board positions. Prior to joining EY, he was a cardiologist in hospital settings for over 20 years. I sat down with Yele and asked him to describe the scope of the problem in the US.
If you were to look at the reasons for failing on this level, where would you start? And I know we've spoken before about inequity in medicine. You mentioned missing persons in medicine, which gets to the lack of representation. But where do you start? Why is something that should be improving heading in the wrong direction?
Well, the high maternal mortality rate is just one condition with a broad portfolio of health conditions that are impacted by health inequity. And specific to the high rates of maternal deaths in the United States compared to other countries, we're looking at a very complex issue that has several contributing and interrelated factors. Some of these include access to healthcare. You know, access to quality healthcare in any environment is crucial for timely and appropriate prenatal care and management of pregnancy and pregnancy-related complications in the United States and indeed anywhere. And disparities in healthcare access and lack of affordability of insurance and relevant medications can impact, in particular, marginalized and underserved populations. So that's one issue. Now, secondly, the socioeconomic factors play a significant role in pretty much all healthcare outcomes, including maternal health outcomes. Needless to say, women from low-income backgrounds may face more challenges in accessing healthcare, especially prenatal care. And gaps in prenatal care is a direct driver of complications at birth or after birth. There is a uniqueness about the issue of maternal disparities in the United States, which is relevant to racial and ethnic disparities. There are significant racial and ethnic disparities in maternal mortality rates in America. You know, Black, Indigenous, and other women of color tend to experience disproportionately high rates of maternal mortality compared to Caucasian women. These disparities can be attributed to a myriad of issues, including systemic racism, implicit bias within healthcare systems and society, and the upstream drivers that result in what we call the social determinants of health. And also, I'll stop here and also just mention before I stop, the US healthcare system is complex and fragmented. It's leading to, therefore, variations in quality and continuity of care, lack of coordination, lack of concerted communication across different healthcare providers and stakeholders. This myriad can hinder timely interventions and do contribute to adverse outcomes.
We've spoken about the amount of money allocated to addressing some of the disparity in medicine. I think it's around about the $190 billion mark or thereabouts. But it seems like there is just like little progress is being made in the disparity in maternal mortality. Little progress has been made in other disparities in the healthcare system, despite this spending. Why is the money being spent in the wrong way? Could it be repurposed for different ways? What is going wrong between the intention and some of the allocation of funds and the lack of progress?
That's a very good question and a complex question to answer. But it is true that my team at the US Center for Health Equity published a white paper, I think in February or March this year. We looked at how much money had been invested in the health disparity elimination space across all conditions over the past 20 years. And we found that almost $200 billion had been invested. And I say almost $200 billion because we got publicly available information that led us to that number. But there is likely to have been more because we wouldn't be able to get information from privately held companies. Most of the money came from the federal government, but some came from philanthropy, corporate America. We then tracked evidence for gap closure across multiple dimensions. Maternal mortality was one, cardiometabolic diseases, oncology, cancer, and you name it. There's no gap closure. I emphasize that there was no evidence for gap closure. While there might have been macroeconomic evidence for improvement in population health by way of increased life expectancy, across Caucasians and Blacks, the gap between the two didn't change. And we measure health equity by elimination of those disparity gaps. So why has this happened? Why is it that $200 billion is invested and there is no evidence for gap closure? Our conclusion is that the strategies to drive processes and accountability for gap closure could be optimized. That a lot of activities and initiatives and programs going on, all with good intention, with multiple players, but happening in a very uncoordinated manner. Also, the elephant in the room relevant to the United States is the context of political determinants of health and social determinants of health, upstream drivers that are driven by the fundamental structures in America that were built to have a separate and equal society. Absent of addressing that issue of systemic bias upstream, it isn't surprising that the downstream manifestations persist.
So clearly a complex and multi-layered problem as described by Yele. We'll hear more from Yele in podcasts 2 and 3 of this series when we look at some potential solutions to the problem. Let's hear now from Adonica Shaw, who, like Manisha, has channeled her own shocking lived experience into creating resources and community for women experiencing similar trauma.
Adonica Shaw is a certified international health coach, doula, student midwife, and patient advocate. She is the founder and CEO of Wing Women and is a powerful voice for women who are navigating their reproductive health. Wing Women is a platform she built after a preeclampsia diagnosis in 2017. This experience later became a catalyst for creating the telehealth company, which also provides access to health coaching to women with endometriosis and PCOS. Adonica shared her lived experience with preeclampsia, which developed into eclampsia.
In February 2017, I was about to sit down and have dinner with my family. I'd made bolognese and I was going to watch Game of Thrones. At the time, my then husband and I just had two little kids who were in elementary school. And so for the most part, it was going to be just a regular afternoon and evening. My blood pressure had kind of been up and down throughout the week. And I was very fluffy. You know, that's the way I'll describe it. And I hadn't been feeling good, been feeling a little lethargic. I reported the symptoms to the nursing station. They continued to kind of urge me to come in. But honestly, at the time, just a parent of two children, I'm like, you know, I'm going to end up all the way over there. And they're just going to run tests for 2 hours. And eventually they're going to send me home. And then I will have wasted my entire Sunday afternoon when really I could just be getting prepared for the work week and hanging out with my kids. But they continued to call throughout the day. And eventually I did end up going into the hospital. And at that time, they, you know, informed me that my blood pressure was dangerously high and that I would have to deliver. They explained to me that you have preeclampsia. And, you know, in order to save your baby, you know, the way that most preeclampsia resolves itself is to deliver. And so for me, I had never heard of the terminology preeclampsia, but when somebody positions it to you in a way where you have to choose the health of your baby or not deliver, obviously you're going to choose the delivery. So within a matter of hours, they gave me some medication to develop his lungs, but then I delivered. I remember it was just a markedly different experience than the other two deliveries because with those, both of them were full-term deliveries. And, you know, when the baby comes out, there's a little bit of cheering, there's excitement. The experience with this was very different. There were more people in the room. And then I didn't get to hold him right after, you know, they clamped the cord and then kind of whisked him away. And it wasn't nearly as celebratory. I remember that. It was more solemn. And it was hard to figure out what was going on. I couldn't understand like why everybody was so solemn.
I just wanted to add here that although born at 34 weeks and 6 days, Adonica's son was healthy.
In the days that followed, I ended up in the ICU because my blood pressure hadn't come down. I kept asking for answers. And they were like, you know, maybe you have postpartum preeclampsia. At the hospital I was at was also a training hospital. So I received a myriad of answers over the course of a couple of days. And, you know, about 3 days postpartum, they had continued to kind of check my blood pressure around the clock. it hadn't come down and they wouldn't allow me to go and see my son in the NICU, which was quite frustrating because if you want to have a mom's blood pressure continue to go up, keep her away from her kid. It's not going to go down if you keep her away from the baby. But despite an otherwise safe delivery, I ended up experiencing a code blue. That part happened pretty quickly. You know, I was standing there, or I was sitting in the bed and the nurse was in the door. And I was frustrated because they wouldn't let me go see my son. And I was in the middle of saying something to her, but my vision changed and I started to kind of see what I can only describe as like mirage. And then I just remember kind of turning my body to look at her because I didn't understand what was happening. I saw her say the words code blue. And then shortly thereafter, my vision went. I couldn't see anything. And then I remember not being able to breathe. I remember feeling physically hot and then feeling like, it sounds very generic to be like, and it felt like the room was closing in on me, but it did. It felt like I was kind of being pressurized, if you will. And then I couldn't hear anything. I don't know how long I was out, but when I came back to, the room was full of doctors and nurses. The defibrillator was right next to me, so they used the paddles. I remember just being completely confused, but happy, but confused, like, because I didn't know, like, what happened. So this was considered an eclamptic crisis, which I survived. They let me go home within a couple of days. And to be honest with you, I was so happy to be out of that hospital. And I remember they were like, call us if anything, you know, continues to be a problem. But after going through such a severe experience, like, you're just so happy to get away from the hospital. Let me tell you.
As a women's health advocate, Adonica serves on the Birth Equity Accountability Through Measurement Advisory Panel on the National Committee for Quality Assurance. She's a patient advocate for the Preeclampsia Foundation and Mama's Voices, where she regularly collaborates with institutions like Stanford Medicine and the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative to drive awareness for initiatives around preeclampsia and maternal health to women of color throughout California. She shared the scope of the maternal mortality problem in the U.S.
Well, I have to say it's multi-layered. It's not a simple problem that just came about in the last few years. And I think that is one of the issues that some of us are having in this space because there's heightened interest around what's going on. But the fact is, a lot of these issues have been there, just largely underreported. And so now what has happened over time was that the things that perhaps weren't being widely discussed are so much larger now than if there might have been continued or ongoing attention to them over time. And so now we're at a point of crisis where you have a lot of companies, organizations, advocates stepping up to have the conversations now, but it's so large of an issue that it's almost impossible to chip away at everything at once.
We're going to hear later from Maura Rosenfeld. But to end this first podcast, let's hear a little about why visibility of this issue is so important and why talking about it is the first step to resolution.
I think also part of what the change is actually that we're talking about it. And I think that's quite important because I think a lot of it comes down to the human side as well, not just what technology is available. I think things that just affect women don't get as much attention. And I don't think we can ignore the fact that it happens a lot more to minority women and to women of color. So yeah, there is an element of prejudice, I think. And it's not just prejudice though. I think it's also a combination of not enough awareness and knowledge, both on the side of the clinical teams and also the women themselves. I mean, I think in the end, whether you're a man or a woman, if you need to be vocal in your healthcare. And the more knowledge you have, and I'm not just saying things you picked up off of Google, but the more you understand something you're going through in your body and know to ask questions and bring things up and insist that you be looked at, then the better off you are. And certainly in an issue with pregnancy where some of these situations where the situation can change so quickly, you need to be vocal. And the clinical teams also need to take it more seriously and also realize there are differences that come up in the occurrence and to take things seriously. Women are often dismissed in general. You're being anxious. It's normal. It's supposed to hurt. We're told that about so many things. And in the end, it can lead to a fatal result.
In my conversation with Maura, she talked about the social determinants of health.
Well, I think there's no doubt that stress is one of the worst factors for anybody's health. Certainly for maternal health, it's not only also the health of the mother, but it will also be the health of the baby afterwards. anytime people are in a situation of all the social determinants of health and poverty, they don't have housing security, food security, that just takes their general health status and degrades it so much. So if anything happens, you're already starting out in a place that's much worse. And all the stress that's built upon that really can be fatal and can really, all the data shows that it does shorten your lifespan.
That finishes part one of our podcast series. Join us for part two, where we're going to focus on potential solutions to the problem, and part three, where we're going to look around the world at the global extent of the problem to see if we can find any clues there as to how to tackle the problem in the US.